Our docket is Virginia Board of Medicine versus Dr. Zacherson. Ms. Barrett, it's been a long time since we've seen you. And is it Simon or
Simon?
Simon. Okay. Mr. Simon. Welcome. You may be familiar. You have 15 minutes. Do you wish to reserve any of that time for rebuttal?
I'll reserve 4 minutes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Erin Barrett on behalf of the Virginia Board of Medicine. We're asking this Court to reverse the Circuit Court order and reinstate the Board order, and there's really only one issue before this Court: whether constitutional due process to a meaningful opportunity to be heard includes the right of a respondent before an administrative proceeding to testify as their own expert.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. Isn't the question a little bit different? I mean, there's no question that she had a right to have expert testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Now, it may not be that she's entitled to have anybody serve as an expert, but if she had a qualified person there to serve as an expert, isn't that the question? The board can't arbitrarily deny her a qualified expert. You would agree with that?
I would agree with that, but that wasn't the issue on appeal, Your Honor. The issue on appeal specifically was whether constitutional due process...
Well, the Circuit Court founded it on the due process basis, but it seemed to me they raised the non-constitutional argument as well. Given that they're now appellee, could they win? Even if we were to disagree on the constitutional basis, couldn't they still prevail?
Well, no, Your Honor, because they didn't proffer any additional expert witness on rheumatology. If that were, the board didn't actually deny that any expert on rheumatology couldn't have testified in her defense, simply that the respondent couldn't in a case where the board was determining whether she was even fit to practice medicine.
But what is the basis for saying that somebody who is a licensed rheumatologist, who, by the way, the board clearly believes is familiar with the standard of care and can render appropriate care, because even after the end of this proceeding, they don't take her license away. They send her out to treat patients. There's no interruption in her seeing patients. It strikes me it would be very odd for the board to take the position that she is incompetent to serve as an expert or to know the standard of care for rheumatology and allow her to continue to treat patients. I mean, you can't square that circle, can you?
Well, I would argue that the opposite is also true. The board can't, ahead of hearing the evidence, decide that a respondent is entitled to be an expert, that she is safe and competent to practice.
Sure they can. She's licensed by the Commonwealth as a doctor. You've let her do that already. You've already found her to meet the educational and licensure requirements for a practice of medicine in Virginia. She has a license.
She met the initial requirements, Your Honor, but that does not mean that her current practice is within the standards of care.
But she submitted her CV and she's board certified. She submitted a CV that indicates she's a specialist in rheumatology. Just because she's the respondent, that means she can't be an expert.
Well, there would be a substantial evidence problem there, Your Honor. The board, again, is determining her competence to practice. If the board ahead
of
doing
that... But isn't that a matter of weight rather than admissibility?
Well, arguably, anything could be attacked on weight based on that. If the board already has determined that this person is qualified enough to testify as an expert before the board, then how can they turn around and then discipline that same individual?
Because you're not saying that she's incompetent or doesn't know. You're saying that with regard to patient A, she departed from the standard of care. If your position is correct, then any doctor who's found by a jury in a tort case to have violated the standard of care would be incompetent to practice medicine. That doesn't make any sense.
That's not exactly true, because we're talking about two separate areas. Civil medical malpractice is not the same as the board determining whether a licensee is safe and competent
but
to practice.
But the issue is the same, whether the care met the standard of care. In fact, both parties have cited 801-580-120 as being at least somewhat relevant to determine if somebody who's qualified to testify as an expert. I guess my question to you is, if another person, if she had proffered a rheumatologist who was licensed by the Commonwealth of Virginia, was licensed at the time of the treatment of patient A, was licensed at the time of the hearing, and was board certified, there's no question that that person would have been allowed to testify, assuming it wasn't repetitive or purely cumulative.
Well, I disagree with that, because the panel chair still has discretion to determine if evidence before it is appropriate.
Well, let me ask you this question. Given that the board had called such a person, possibly be the legitimate reason for the board to say, we get to call a board-certified rheumatologist, but you, the respondent, do not?
The board never did that, and the board would not do that.
Well, right. But my hypothetical, you said no, they still would have the ability to do that. If the person was a board-certified rheumatologist with an active clinical practice, why wouldn't that person qualify as an expert on the standard of care in Virginia?
And again, it goes back to, if we want to use medical malpractice as an illustrative example, although it's not applicable to administrative hearings, there are ways to rebut the presumption. And the tribunal must determine if those presumptions are rebutted or not.
But your argument then becomes entirely circular. Because they ruled against her at the end of the day, we can support the decision we made that she doesn't qualify as an expert. But, of course, you can't reach that determination until after you've considered all the evidence. You're not saying the board had prejudged it and said, we're going to end up ruling against you, therefore you're not an expert. You're not saying that.
I think we're jumping ahead here. The board didn't say you are not qualified to testify as an expert. If you look at the transcript, the panel chair said, you must testify as the respondent. The board wanted the respondent to testify to the factual nature, not as a testifying expert. They did not state she wasn't qualified.
But isn't that a strategy decision up to respondent's counsel? I mean, the doctor's counsel should decide, you know, who to put on as an expert and who not to put on as an expert?
Yes, it is, but I would submit it's unusual for a party in a...
It doesn't matter. If it's lawful, it can be as unusual as anything. I mean, what's the law that prohibits somebody from putting on the respondent to testify?
There is no law, but there's also no law requiring the board to submit that a respondent must be a testifying expert for due process reasons.
Well, consistent with either due process or just proper legal procedures, and I'm going to ask you if there's a difference does the common law believe there's a difference? If the person was qualified, can the board reject otherwise relevant, admissible evidence for arbitrary reasons?
Not for arbitrary reasons, no.
Okay. Now, the Virginia Supreme Court, in multiple cases granted in the civil context, has made clear that one can serve as one's own expert. You know, it calls to mind the Ben Franklin quote about having a fool for a client, but you can serve as your own expert, both in Smith versus... Irving and Christian versus Surgical Specialists, they strongly suggest that you can. And then in the State Farm Mutual Auto Insurance versus Kendrick case, Dr. Kendrick was the plaintiff in a personal injury action and wanted to serve as his own expert regarding medical care. And the circuit court said you can't do that, you're self-interested, gave the same reason the board gave. And the Supreme Court of Virginia said, no, that's not right. And in fact, Virginia actually passed a statute, 81-396, I know the formal rules of evidence don't apply to board proceedings, that removed the disability that attached to common law to serving as your own witness. So if she's otherwise qualified, is it a problem to not allow her to testify?
No, it's not, because I submit those are different types of cases. This, to me, would be the equivalent of
What authority do you have for your position? Judge Russell gave you several pieces of authority for his. What authority do you have that says it's different when it's in the context of an APA scenario?
There's nothing that specifically addressed this issue in the context of APA administrative proceedings in the Commonwealth. And again, I submit that a party can act as its own expert, but it is always at the discretion of the tribunal.
Well, the tribunal cannot arbitrarily reject somebody as an expert, and it can't be simply that we're going to have a battle of the experts means one of them is not an expert. That can't be the answer, because in every contested case, that would mean you're finding essentially that one party's not an expert. One of the witnesses, I mean, if the experts disagree about what the appropriate standard of care is. Now, it's up to the board to determine which one they believe and which one they accept, and you can reject it after the fact. But the question of whether they qualify as an expert has to be made before that decision is made.
However, this again raises the substantial evidence issue that would affect the agencies of the Commonwealth, because they have to have substantial evidence for their decisions. And when this issue is raised to a circuit court, say that a respondent testifies as an expert in a standard of care medical case regarding a specialty. The Commonwealth presents their own expert, that perhaps has shorter testimony or maybe not as many documents. The appellant ends up being the respondent who is sanctioned, goes to the circuit court level, challenges the decision on substantial evidence. And then what is the board to do? The board has to point to this and say, yes, the respondent was recognized as an expert in this field. And the board, although it had a competing expert that perhaps didn't testify for quite as long, the Commonwealth put on an expert that didn't testify quite as fulsomely, the board is then faced with defending its decision that perhaps they revoked the license of the doctor of medicine.
But isn't the answer, yes, the person met the educational and licensure qualifications for an expert and could serve as an expert, but we just simply didn't believe them. And the board, as fact finder, is entitled to complete deference on the factual finding that the testimony of the doctor was unbelievable. But here, if you say you don't even get to testify as an expert, that's not a factual finding, that's a legal finding, isn't it?
It is, but again, Your Honor, she testified extensively here. She testified regarding the facts of the case.
As a lay witness.
As a lay witness, but she presented articles in support of this. She submitted all of this to the board.
Can I clarify with you?
Yes.
It seems what the Commonwealth is arguing here is that if you are the respondent, despite what your CV says, you cannot be an expert witness. Is that right, or are you
it's
not?
It's not that it could not be an expert witness. It's that would not testify as an expert in their own matter.
So basically, I mean, so if you're a respondent, you can never testify as an expert witness in your own matter because the board is deciding whether you're perhaps even still fit to practice medicine. Is that right?
Likely, yes. Although, again, this is entirely at the discretion of the panel chair.
So earlier I heard you say it wasn't a per se rule, and now you're saying it's a per se rule.
No,
I mean,
I'm
it's
saying
either
it's
an
the discretion of the panel chair,
or it's a per se.
No,
rule.
I'm saying that it's still at the discretion of the panel chair in each individual case, but it's unlikely.
But you're offering no rule from which to utilize that discretion. It's just completely, totally unbridled discretion, and that actually might raise a constitutional problem. But I'd like to ask you a different question.
Yes.
If it's simply not every erroneous evidentiary ruling gives rise to a due process problem. If the board simply got the evidentiary ruling wrong, if she meets all the qualifications as an expert and should have been allowed to testify as an expert, are we allowed to review that determination?
Excuse me, which determination are you looking at?
If the record demonstrates that it was arbitrary and erroneous to not allow her to testify as an expert, but we find that's just an evidentiary ruling and not a violation of due process. It's just an erroneous evidentiary ruling. Do we have the authority under 224.027 to reach that?
That is not before this court on appeal.
Well, except it was part of their argument in the circuit court. I know the circuit court didn't decide it on that basis, but they're now here as appellee.
I see where you're getting to, Judge. Yes. It's not. Even if it was a procedure that was not properly followed, here there was no ultimate change, and it was harmless error in this case.
How do we know that? Because your argument earlier is that the Commonwealth will be prejudiced and have to have an expert in every single case, because you have one side with an expert and one side without an expert. The side without the expert is always going to be in a prejudiced position.
That was not my position for any matter at all. It's where a respondent is testifying as an expert, a respondent specifically, because of the substantial evidence problem. But here, you cannot erase this appellee's extensive defense before the board. The majority of a two-day hearing about the treatment to one patient was put on by the appellee.
And we're deep into your rebuttal time, and I'll probably give you an extra minute because we've taken up a lot of your time. But there was testimony about discs that she wished to submit into evidence.
That were submitted into evidence and reviewed by the panel prior to the hearing.
And they were submitted into evidence. There's no question they were part of the record. They were part of the record, and they're part of the record on appeal.
Yes.
Mr. Simon, welcome to Virginia.
Good morning, and thank you. I seem to do this countrywide, but thank you for the welcome. I was wondering if I need a formal introduction by
Please.
This is my local counsel, Greg Skull, and I was admitted to Pohagvice, and you look at the original counsel from scratch in the hearing. And I do want to start by pointing you to the specific page where Ms. Barrett elucidated the ruling of the panel, which is record page 190, where she herself interjected because the chairman he didn't want to play on words, he didn't want to be definitive on the ruling, and I kept on saying, are you saying that Dr. Zacherson cannot testify here as an expert because she is a respondent? Many times he was saying that is correct, but he was trying to slip and slide. At page 190, Ms. Barrett herself interjected and made that clear, that she is not allowed to testify as an expert because she's the respondent.
Do you agree with me that not every erroneous adverse evidentiary ruling gives rise to a due process problem?
To the extent that it doesn't raise to a constitutional violation, over here it did. Why did it raise to a constitutional...
But the question is, there are instances where it may not rise to a constitutional...
Evidentiary rulings? Yes.
Okay.
And then let me ask this question, and I know you're going to say no, but it seems to me what this is potentially an erroneous decision regarding the qualification of an expert. They didn't bar expert testimony. They may have erroneously said that this person doesn't qualify. Now, assume for a moment, and I'll let you tell me why I'm wrong in a minute, but assume for a moment I'm right. May we reach that under the Virginia APA and say that there was legal error?
Okay, you wanted me to answer, Judge Russell, did you want me to answer the hypothetical first?
First.
Okay, so if somebody, the hypothetical, the way I understand it is, if somebody is barred from acting as an expert for lack of qualifications,
wrong.
And that is wrong. Do you have authority to review it? You have authority to review it?
Yes.
You do, because that's an arbitrary and capricious standard. So that would absolutely have authority to review it. But over here, we don't really have harmless error.
Now give the answer that you wanted to give. Answer the question.
Well, no, I wanted to answer the hypothetical first. But in Boe versus Burson, the Fourth Circuit said that a hearing has to be in the context of the facts pertaining to the case. Over here, we have rheumatology issues. And they presented their rheumatology expert, who raised an array of constitutional challenges below that the circuit court didn't reach. But when it came to rheumatology, it's exactly like Judge Decker said. My client was only allowed to act as a lay witness. And the focus of the pages in the record that support that are pages 175 through 190, where she tried to get into the articles, into the science that supported her medical rationale behind the treatments, and the chairman cut her off. And many times she said, you're not going, and that's what the circuit court said, or they're doing an oral argument, you're not going to act as an expert witness.
Why shouldn't the chairman have at least some discretion in that regard? Because otherwise, you face a situation where everyone before the Board of Medicine, and they're trying to decide whether they should revoke their license or whether they should just receive an oral reprimand. I mean, it could cover the entire spectrum of possible sanctions. The doctor says, well, I'm an expert in my field, and I want to be able to testify as an expert. Why shouldn't the chair or the board at least be able to say, no, you're the respondent here?
Well, we qualified because of the reasons that the bench articulated before. We qualified. If you go through the record, I went through great length of establishing as an expert rheumatologist. And then I offered her formally as an expert rheumatologist after I established her credential.
But her decisions as a physician, even if she is a specialist and an expert, Her decisions are being severely questioned here. So why should she not have, if she wants to have an expert in rheumatology, hire her own expert as she did with infectious diseases, I believe it was.
But we're back to the question as to why a respondent should not answer on their own behalf as an expert. Judge Russell quoted the case law, which says that she can. We propounded her. She had particular knowledge. This was, if you look at the charges, Judge Beals, this has to do with the treatment of Lyme disease by alternative means, okay? And that there was that community versus this community, which is controversial nationwide. And she had particular expertise in this particular field. The panel did not. And it's important to hear from somebody whose particular expertise in that particular field to make a decision. And it's like...
What would have been different about her presentation of evidence, her testimony, what she submitted on disk? What substantive information would have been different than what was provided?
The correlation. The correlation is important because...
Okay. All right. At any point in the proceeding before the board, did you proffer the correlation?
Yes, I did. And those are the pages that I pointed you in here, pages 175 through 190. Okay. And he cut us off.
That's the discussion of the literature,
yeah,
where she was trying to make the connection.
Well, right. But the witness has to say, I would have testified X, Y, and Z. Virginia's proffer rules are very, very specific, and that the failure to proffer the questions that would have been asked and the answers that would have been given can be fatal to a claim of a failure to allow expert testimony at trial. And I guess my question is, now all of that information was admitted into evidence by way of the disks, as best I can tell, but she wanted the opportunity to tie them all together, but there was no proffer of how she would have tied them all together. As I review the record, if I'm wrong on that, tell me where.
Because they didn't let us. When she started to tie it all together at pages 175 through 190, the chairman of the board cut us off.
And did you then say, I would like to proffer for the record?
I said that I want her to testify and correlate the... I absolutely said it in here. I said that I wanted her to correlate the scientific evidence to what the treatments
where
are.
Specifically in 175 and 190?
It's not enough to say, I want her to say that. It's she would say X, Y, and Z, what she would have specifically testified to, because we have to evaluate whether she was prejudiced by not being allowed to give the testimony that she wasn't allowed to give. It's not enough to say they said I couldn't give the evidence. We have to know what evidence was rejected, what specific evidence was rejected. They said she can't testify as an expert. I've got that. And I see in 175 and 190 where that is said. Where do you say what she would have said if she had been allowed to testify?
I did, actually.
Take your time, because this is important.
Yes, I did. Pages 185 through 186, I'm telling the chairman on how it is that she would connect the evidence and present the evidence to the panel in such a fashion as to respond to the particular allegations. Page 187, I said that she wants to discuss why she did something, how she did it, and she's addressing specifically what the witnesses, that the state witnesses said, and you are precluding her from doing so because the state witness presented the expert with particular testimony, and she was precluded from answering.
At the bottom of page 185, that's the quote you just said, and that is why she is telling you how it is and how she did it. And the board chairman says, I would be perfectly happy for her to do that.
Yes.
Okay, so that doesn't...
To note the citation and move on. But what she was doing, if you look in the prior testimony, is she is rebutting what Dr. Lewis was saying at pages 182 through 184, Judge. She is rebutting specifically what Dr. Lewis, the Commonwealth's expert rheumatologist, was saying, and that's where they cut us off. Because she's not an expert. And he said, she cannot testify here as an expert. If you want to rebut what their expert said, you can do it tomorrow through Dr. Horowitz, who was not a rheumatology expert.
Well, right. But then at that point, we need a record that says that, okay, the article on page, you know, there's reference here to 27% of the tests are false positives or what have you. We need some elucidation of that to be able to evaluate that things would have been different if she had been allowed to testify as an expert. Because, I mean, that is... It's not enough to show that she should have been allowed to testify as an expert. You have to show that the result would have been different or may have been different. And And the question is, if we don't know what she would have said specifically, how do we know that?
Well, if they cut us off, how could we say it specifically? They didn't let us present it.
Well, and that's when you say, I need to make a proffer. And if they then don't allow you to make the proffer, then you're in a different circumstance.
Well, they...
Did you ever put anything in writing as to why she should be allowed to testify as an expert?
I put it...
No, I mean, did you ever file anything, any... We're at a little bit of a disadvantage because the discs aren't here yet for some reason. But
yeah, at the beginning we're supposed to designate the experts and to designate our witnesses and everything else. And that's another thing. They never objected. We never knew that she was not going to be allowed to testify as an expert because there would have been motions on that at the beginning. But the state didn't challenge her as an expert when we offered her CV and we offered her as an expert. We designated Dr. Horowitz with his CV and the report and we designated her. The state, the Commonwealth, did not raise any objections. We did not know there were going to be objections until the hearing, until the chairman said, but she's not going to be your expert. And then I said, but wait a minute. They were allowed to bring an expert. Why aren't we? And the answer was unequivocally, because she's the respondent.
I think what Judge Decker is asking, at least this is my follow-up question, is once they would not let you do it, even if you were surprised by that, did you file anything with the Board of Medicine saying, okay, this is what we would have proffered. This is what she would have said in regard to correlating these things. That what they wouldn't let you put in, you've tried to put it in through writing as a proffer.
They issued that order that day in 3 hours. I had no time to go do anything.
You didn't ask for them to reconsider, right?
That was the final order that we took up on appeal. With the circuit court. There was no reconsideration. There was nothing in the order giving me time for reconsideration. There was no post-hearing briefs, nothing.
Okay, regarding the discs that were admitted, would she have said anything that wasn't contained on the discs? And if the answer is no, then all of what she would have said was in front of the board, and the only question, doesn't your argument then become... But because she was denied the imprimatur of having an expert testify to that, that's inherently prejudicial.
Well, no. An expert presents literature, presents the science behind the medical procedure, and is allowed to rebut the Commonwealth expert. She was specifically disallowed to rebut the Commonwealth expert. So the answer would be no.
And when the chair made the ruling on that, you didn't ask to continue the hearing so that you could get another expert.
That was never an issue with the chair. The chair did not say you should go get another expert.
No, but I mean you never asked.
I know, I made my objection on the record to the ruling at the time as the hearing was progressing, and I said that the ruling is out of whack.
Right. I just wanted to verify that. Because I didn't see it. At no point did you ever say, we need to take a breath here and I need to find another expert because you just said, my expert can't testify.
No.
Okay.
No. That's not in the record.
Okay.
So, pretty much I just want to sum up. You are correct. There are some evidentiary rulings that do not raise to constitutional violations. Not to be able to present witnesses to rebut the Commonwealth expert witness, and there was a specific preclusion in the record, that is a constitutional due process violation.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's assume for a moment that the person wasn't qualified, did not have the qualifications, and you wanted to offer them, and the judge found that, and the board found that the person didn't qualify as an expert. That's not a due process violation.
Of course not, but that wasn't the finding here. The finding here is because she's the respondent, she cannot even...
Well, right, but that goes to whether the finding was erroneous or not. It doesn't necessarily go to whether it is a constitutional violation.
Well, it does. And the reason why it's a constitutional violation is that, again, the hearing has to be within the context of the case itself. This had rheumatology problems. The Commonwealth had an expert in rheumatology, and not allowing the respondent or the appellee here to rebut what their expert witness said simply because she's the respondent. And she should be allowed to testify as an expert against the rheumatology expert to rebut what it is that she said. That would be a deprivation of due process because now you have something uneven. You have the state having an expert in rheumatology, and the respondent being denied due process because she cannot present expert testimony.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you.
Ms. Barrett, and I promise you an extra minute, and we'll give it to you.
Thank you. I would like to address the issue of presenting Dr. Zacherson as an expert. Prior to the hearing, she did submit her CV in a narrative statement that is fairly regular with Board of Medicine respondents. They typically.
So your point is that there was a proffer as to what she would have testified to?
It was not couched as such. It was with the rest of her evidence that was also submitted. Doctors regularly submit their CVs when they're trying to show the board that they are safe and confident to practice and they have the qualifications to back that up. That's not unusual. So the board heard for the first time that she was going to testify as an expert when she was offered as an expert at the hearing.
In determining whether somebody qualifies to testify as an expert in a board proceeding, and I know you've said that 801-580-120, while doesn't technically apply, and even though it's stricter than the Virginia Rule of Evidence on expert testimony, the Virginia Rule of Evidence doesn't technically apply because the board has a more liberal standard, it seems, although you may be making it a more conservative standard in this case. What standard does the board apply in determining on whether somebody qualifies to give expert testimony? Because it can't just be whatever the board thinks at a given moment. That's arbitrary and capricious. If it's not the 801-581-20 standard, meaning that doesn't qualify you as an expert, and it's not the standard in the Virginia Rules of Evidence for expert testimony generally, what standard is to be applied, and how is anybody supposed to know that ahead of time?
Well, that's a problem with administrative rules, unfortunately, is that the evidence rules, as you noted, are quite wide. Since it is the discretion of the panel chair.
But that tends to let more stuff in, and you're trying to keep stuff out. How do I know
exactly
what standard, other than we just think that she shouldn't be allowed to testify as an expert, what standard can be applied?
I think we would have to make one up here if we were to do that, but I would submit that it would be qualifications for a standard testifying expert and potentially using other case law as illustrative, such as Wright v. K. Well, not under Wright v. K. She doesn't. She would not have met the knowledge requirement to testify.
Yes, she would have, because you can't make that determination after you determine she's wrong. You have to make it ex ante. You can't wait and say, we've decided this violates the standard of care, therefore it was right not to qualify her as an expert because you've already disqualified her before you've heard the evidence. You have to wait until you hear the evidence to then say she's wrong.
Your point is taken, Judge, and I see that I'm out of time, so I will conclude by once again requesting that you overturn the circuit court's decision and reinstate the board order. Thank you.
Ms. Barrett.